Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The 2-0. Ichiro to right and deep. Back goes Parra to the wall, and it's off the wall. 3,000 is in right field, and Ichiro is racing for third. And he's done it. He's climbed the mountain. A triple. And he has arrived at 3,000.
Baseball history made today.
This is a tough day. I love this game, and I love this team. And today, I'm saying goodbye to both. This is also a proud day. I was 18 when I broke into the big leagues. I never thought I could play for 22 years. At 18, I just wanted to make a team. I want to thank the Steinbrenner family for giving me this opportunity. No athlete ever ends his career or her career the way you want to. We all want to keep playing forever, but it doesn't work that way. Accepting the end gracefully is part of being a professional athlete. Saying goodbye may be the hardest part of the job, but that's what I'm doing today.
All this excitement's got me wanting to call Ed Werder and spread the word again. I was pretty certain at 14 years old of what I was going to do in my future, and that was I was going to be the next Roger Staubach or Archie Manning or Joe Montana. Of course, I didn't have many choices. It was football, baseball, or bust for me. I had dreamed of playing the NFL, believe me, way more than I thought about my schoolwork. I thought about being Archie Manning, running around throwing underhand passes. I thought about being my childhood favorite, Roger Staubach, throwing it to Preston Pearson or Drew Pearson, handing it off to Tony Dorsett, being Kenny Stabler coming out of the tunnel. I'd thought of those things so many times, but I never thought of the Hall of Fame until that moment. And so a new goal had entered my mind then and there. And I said to myself, I will make it to the Hall of Fame.
The NFL's Hall of Fame game was canceled because the field is in such poor shape.
From what I've been told, the wrong paint was used, and if you could get out there and see it, it had dried. It was very sticky. It was very gummy. It was almost like taffy.
And while a field full of taffy would be delicious, it would also be very unsafe. Cleats could get caught up in the gunk and cause a nasty leg injury, which is the last thing anyone wants in a preseason game. The NFL issued a statement saying, "We are very disappointed for our fans, but player safety is our primary concern, and as a result, we could not play an NFL game on this field tonight."
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, the extravaganza is back right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, thanks so much for joining us. The NFL was back last night, was it not? The NFL was supposed to be back last night. It was not. There's a different way of saying it with the same exact words. It was not. How about the Hall of Fame game being killed? What did they say? It was like taffy? Who was that, Jim, in that report?
It was one random report about the whole thing. I was mainly getting it for the NFL
like
statement
one of our
about
interns.
It.
I swear to God, the voice sounded like it was one of our interns. Play that back again. I know I've heard that voice before. Play that. Can you isolate just the last clip, or would you have to start the whole thing over again? Because that is incredible to me that the NFL couldn't get the right. And by the way, the NFL should be ashamed of itself. Roger Goodell and anybody else associated with planning, the preseason and the Hall of Fame game and everything else, because they're throwing the people at Canton, David Baker, in charge of that game, under the bus, as if he was supposed to be the one painting the field, as if it was their decision.
Right.
If it was, I mean, this was a National Football League sanctioned event.
Yep.
It's an NFL game. They're the ones responsible for everything from the officiating crew to the equipment to the right balls to the field, all of it. And they just basically said, it's a narwhal. This is all we're going to throw it on David Baker. David Baker's going to take the heat for this, the guy who's in charge of the Hall of Fame game. What a load of crap that was. Do you have that cut?
Yeah. Let me go ahead and play from the beginning.
The NFL's Hall of Fame game was canceled because the field is in such poor shape.
from what I've been told, the wrong paint was used. And if you could get out there and see it, it had dried. It was very sticky. It was very gummy. It was almost like taffy.
And while a field full of taffy would be delicious, it would also be very unsafe. Cleats could get caught up in the gunk and cause a nasty leg injury, which is the last thing anyone wants in a preseason.
Who is that?
The NFL issued a statement saying we are very disappointed.
I have no idea whose voice that is,
but it sure sounds
like our old buddy Ben, doesn't it?
Maybe.
I'll have to check with him, see if he's doing something on the side that I don't know about.
It sounded like, I swear to God, like an intern or something. Especially the way he over-enunciated every syllable.
Yeah, that's true.
And it might cause a nasty leg injury to... who is that reporter? Where did you pull that?
I got it off of the various YouTube clips on all this stuff yesterday.
We got to find out. We got to give attribution.
Sure. Okay.
We got to give attribution and retribution at the same time. It was awful. Welcome to a Monday edition. We got so many things to talk about today, so many different things to do. Honestly, the Hall of Fame game canceled last night because of the type of paint that they used, for goodness sakes, the kind of paint they used. You heard that correctly. The clip you played, Jim, describe it as being taffy-like. What I heard last night was that it was like concrete.
Yeah, hardened. Yeah, that's the other part that I heard, that they had changed out the field turf that they had on that field, which I know some complained about last year, particularly Pittsburgh Steeler people, because Swisham, the kicker, injured himself, his ACL or something. So they changed out the turf, and the way it was described to me, you know, my first thought was, oh, so you basically imported the old vet from Philly. That's brilliant.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, I heard they were canceling it from because of field conditions, and I'm thinking to myself, what on earth is wrong? It's a turf field. There's no weather. What are we doing here? When I finally found out it was paint, because I didn't have it on from the beginning.
Right.
But when I found out it was the paint, and I heard them say it was the kind of paint that hardens, and it was like cement in the end zones and at that midfield logo, which, of course, is certainly a player safety hazard. One of the players described it as being unable for a cleat to penetrate, that your cleats wouldn't even go through it in order to give you grip. It would be like, you know, hard, like I said, like walking on a... you know, on blacktop or something.
Right, right. Again, for me, why I thought, oh, you mean like the old vet in Philly. That was renowned for being horrible.
What I just don't understand is, how do you find paint that isn't standard field paint? You know what I mean? It's like, how does the wrong paint... I mean, I know somebody got fired over this today. Probably by the end of the day yesterday. Maybe multiple people did. But when you're ordering field paint to prepare the field for Hall of Fame Day, I don't know. Maybe I'm just totally naive to the ways of the world. But I'm thinking to myself, there can't be too many places that sell the paint that NFL stadiums use to put on their field when they decorate their fields.
Right. I'm pretty sure you can't go to Walmart and get this stuff.
Exactly. I'm pretty sure there's one company that contracts with the NFL that sends them their paint. That, you know, here's the paint for, you know, whatever colors you want. If you're doing you remember the old TV commercial for Snickers, the Chef's commercial? Instead of Chiefs, it was Chef's.
Yes.
you know, whether it's red and you're doing the Chef's, or whether it's white or red, white, and blue and you're doing something for military theme day, or just your normal team colors, orange and brown stadium, or the Honolulu blue, or whatever it is, I just feel like you're getting it from the same place. So how in the hell did they end up with several, you won't call it buckets because I don't know what they use. They use sprayers, obviously. But several vats of paint that is not NFL field paint. Was somebody on their way to the stadium when they prepared that field last night? Was somebody, because it had to have been put down a couple of days early at least, maybe a week early. And nobody noticed it, by the way. Was somebody just on their way, one of the workers, and say, sale? Look at that. I see a sale over there at Sherwin-Williams. Let's just go get some of that. Oh my, holy cow, did you see the deal they got going on at Depot on Bear paint? Let's head to Depot. Wait, what? How on earth does the NFL, a conglomerate that is bigger than the national economy of most European nations, how does the National Football League allow somebody to go and buy budget paint and slap it on their beautiful new hybrid turf there in Canton? And then, by the way, nobody checked it. Nobody went out and walked it. Nobody checked the field the day before the game, 2 days before the game, to see, oh, my God, guys, look at this. Somehow it hardened. They didn't paint it yesterday. If they were painting yesterday, then they were going about this whole thing all wrong. They had to have painted that at least a week ago, probably 2 weeks ago, to get that ready for the game. I don't know what else was going on that field in that period of time. There can't be really anything.
No, there wouldn't have been. There
high schools and colleges aren't even playing yet. They're just practicing. There's no scrimmages yet.
Exactly.
So the field is sitting there dormant. It's empty. There's nothing going on. I have to believe they painted it up for the Hall of Fame 2016 ceremonial game, preseason game, probably at least a week ahead of time. And nobody, no grounds crew people, no maintenance people, nobody from the league itself, nobody came there and checked it out and walked the field and saw that, hey, why is it when I walk on the 5-yard line, everything feels great, but I walk into the end zone, I just slipped and fell on my ass. Why? How do they not realize, oh, my God, that's like a cement driveway yep. there or blacktop there? What a bunch of – what is this? How embarrassing is this for the NFL? Jim, I don't know if I've seen anything quite this embarrassing in a long time, other than maybe suspending your most popular player of his era and maybe the greatest quarterback of all time 4 games for some stupid idiotic deflate thing.
Right.
Fighting with him for 2.5 years or a year and a half over it. But other than that, this might be the most embarrassing thing they've done.
Yeah, and that's quite frankly saying a lot, considering some of the embarrassing and questionable things that have come from on high in the NFL in these last couple years. I mean, yeah, how does this get messed up like that? Is just it's beyond comprehension. As you put it, for a league that generates more than a whole bunch of countries on this earth, and you can't get a simple field right. That's such
it's just
garbage.
Bizarre.
Just
I mean,
bizarre.
You know, it's almost an only in CLE kind of a thing, an only in Cleveland moment. And I don't know if we can use that anymore since Cleveland finally won their championship. But it's close because it's Canton, so it's closer to Cleveland than it is anywhere else. just to throw that out there. But it's just what an embarrassment for the NFL. So we're going to get into that a little bit. Want to get your thoughts on it, too. The Hall of Fame inductions. Brett Favre rambled on for about 35 minutes. And as you heard in Jim's quick little montage, he repeated himself apparently quite a bit. Because even in that little clip that Jim just played, he repeated himself about
right.
Archie Manning and Roger Staubach and so on and so forth. He was winging it. He said, why should I write a speech? I'm going to wing it the way I played my whole career. And that, which is interesting. That's basically saying I'm going to make it up as I go. And he was the ultimate make it up as you go, play it off the cuff, ad lib kind of quarterback.
Yeah.
And while that might be neat, it also kind of, sort of, in a way, undermines his Hall of Fame credentials, to be quite honest with you. Because by saying I'm going to wing it the way I did my entire career, you're essentially saying I didn't prepare. I'm going to make it up as I go. And I feel like if he hadn't been such a, you know, a riverboat gambler, if he hadn't been so make it up as I go kind of a thing that he was, and maybe prepared a little bit more, his numbers, as great as they were, would have been way better, especially in terms of completion percentage and fewer interceptions. And maybe, just maybe, there's more than just the one Super Bowl championship to show for that incredible career, 20 years of at the helm that Brett Favre had. I found it interesting. And he made it up as he went. And, you know, it's kind of neat because he's obviously speaking from the heart. There's no prepared remarks there where you're trying to make yourself sound a certain way. He just spoke from the gut, and I respect that. But when he played, I kind of wish it would have been a little bit more scripted and a little bit more prepared, you know?
Yeah, I follow you on that one. You know, there's definitely something to be said about that. You know, at the same time, yes, by being off the cuff, you knew he was speaking from the heart. But it does kind of parallel, as you put it, for kind of his career on the field,
well,
kind of winging it in this.
You know, that's how he put it, as he said. He said, you know, kind of the way he did it his entire
Although,
career.
Among the many clips, because he went on for quite a long time in his particular speech, one of the clips I did not include the montage, you mentioned his interceptions. According to his mother, no interception was ever his fault.
No, of course not. By the way, speaking of moms, how about Joey Bosa's mom coming out? Coming out after the Chargers. Joey Bosa's mom getting Bosa's back. The report was from SD, SanDiegoBoltReport.com, and it was later removed. It was written in response to a note from a Facebook user who said he hoped it turned out well for your son. The Chargers are horrible at stopping the running game. Bosa's mother, Cheryl, wrote in response, it bums me out to watch, it bums me out for him so much. Wish we had pulled an Eli Manning on draft day. Whoa! Settle down, Joey's mom. And by the way, I don't know how well that's going to go for Joey in the Chargers locker room and probably when he does sign and finally gets on the field and his opponents get a hold of this. Mom fighting his battles for him. Mama Bosa going out there in defense of her son saying, I wish we would have pulled. And she said we, by the way, not he.
Right.
We would have pulled an Eli Manning on draft day. We all remember Archie Manning famously said he did not want his son Eli to play for the Chargers. So when the Chargers drafted him number one overall in 2004, they were listening and they immediately took him with the plan to trade him to the Giants for Phillip Rivers, whom the Giants selected at number four. Obviously, it worked out pretty well for both teams, more for the Giants since they have two Super Bowl championships to show for it. But Phillip Rivers has been one of the best quarterbacks of the last 11 or 12 years in the National Football League. No question about that. But how about that? Mama Bosa saying the Chargers aren't playing fair. I wish we had been taken by someone else or had pulled or engineered an Eli Manning.
That's just nuts right there. And it should make the Chargers look a little bad. And what's interesting, you know, long term about that is they don't need anything else bad because being mentioned about them in a way, because they're still, of course, rumored to be leaving San Diego. So that's just what you need is your top draft pick basically saying, hey, I wish you would have pulled off an Eli Manning and not drafted me or traded me or something. That's just a horrible look.
Yeah, it really is. And you know what's really weird about it is, I mean, why is this happening? I thought the slotting system pretty much made everything good to go. Is the number two pick signed? Yes. Is the number four pick signed? Yes, then your deal ought to be somewhere in the middle. Isn't that the way they kind of set this up anymore?
Yes, it's not, or at least that's how I thought. I could be missing something now, but I thought that's how it was done.
But he was selected number three overall. He's the only first-round pick who has not signed with his team. Like I said, number two is signed, number four is signed, number five is signed, all the way down the line, and number one, of course. So all you got to do is just find that number in the middle there. What is the problem? And the problem, according to Adam Schefter at ESPN, Bosa's team and the Chargers have not even had any contact since the end of July. Today's the 8th. Preseason starts Friday. Supposed to start last night. We'll see how the paint goes Friday. But seriously.
You have to ask that now, don't you?
They haven't even met in the last 8 days. They haven't talked. Not even by phone, according to the Schefter report. No contact since the end of July when Bosa's representatives provided a counterproposal before the start of training camp. They remained in an impasse over offset language and other in the earlier payment of deferred signing bonus money. No end in sight. The Chargers have until tomorrow to trade his rights, but the organization is not thinking along those signs, according to Schefter. We're going through install, and we're always going to be that way, whatever that means. Mike McCoy said when asked about Bosa's absence, we're going to worry about the guys who are here right now. I guess that means installing the offense, defense, game plan, et cetera. We're not going to worry about guys who aren't here. We've got an install to do, and guys have to master our system, and then Joey has to catch up when he gets here. That's all they would say. So interesting story out there out of San Diego by way of Columbus, Ohio, and number three overall pick, Joey Bosa. A little closer to home in the National Football League preseason style. Preseason, again, starting on Friday. The Browns made it official. You heard in the montage there, Robert Griffin III is back to being an NFL starting quarterback. He lost his job in Washington when he lost, quite frankly, favor of the coaches, and then eventually lost out to Kirk Cousins. But he is now going to be the starting quarterback for the Cleveland Browns, and that is something I have to tell you I'm very, very happy about. I've been a fan of Robert Griffin III.
One of 32 in this league, so... You take that, you respect that, and you continue to go out and work and try to get better. You should never doubt. There's a quote out there, and it says, if you don't believe, who will? So I'm thankful for my teammates and coach, Coach Jackson, Sashi, and all these guys for believing in me as a player.
I like that humble attitude. I really do. That, of course, is one of Robert Griffin III's undoings in Washington. If you listen to those who played with him and those who covered the team on a regular basis in D.C., Robert Griffin III was just a little too elitist, a little too, I'm better than all you, or even if he didn't say those things, it's how he carried himself. He presented himself a certain way that he wanted to be viewed, and it just rubbed a whole lot of people the wrong way. So if this is just part of that, and it's a presentation, then that's unfortunate because I like how it sounds. I hope it's real and genuine and sincere and not a part of just presenting the package that you want to be shown. Because I like the humility I just heard there. He said, it's an honor to be one of 32 in this league. And it's true. There's only 32 starting quarterbacks in this league. And it is the most difficult position to play in I think, all of team sports. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. And, you know, for him to just, you know, kind of couch it that way and say, I want to pay respect to what I have and the opportunity I have before me, and I'm going to do the best I can with it. That's a great attitude to have. I really, 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 really have liked RG3 since way back at Baylor. I felt very badly about the way things turned out for him in Washington, and I really hope I wanted him to turn it around no matter what. I wanted him to turn it around. I wanted him to get out of D.C., and I don't care if he went to Tampa or if he went to Tennessee or if he went to Seattle or anywhere else. And I know I'm just picking names out. Those teams already have starting quarterbacks,
right.
Winston, Mariota, and Wilson, to be respectively, just to clarify that. But my point being, I don't care where he was. If he'd have gone to Houston, you know, they ended up with Brock Osweiler. If he'd have gone to – who else changed quarterbacks this year? Philadelphia. If they'd have gone, although Philadelphia is in a very odd situation now with Bradford and Wentz, but point being, I would have been rooting for him to succeed because I like him. And I feel like the talent is still there, and I feel like it's really unfortunate that he went from the offensive rookie of the year over Andrew Luck, by the way, to being just a journeyman cast off. And I think he's better than that, but he went to my team. He went to Cleveland. He went to the Browns, so even more so, I was so thrilled to find out that he was indeed named officially the starting quarterback of the Browns.
Yeah, and to a certain degree, this shouldn't be a surprise to Browns fans that he got named the starter. I mean, I know there's been all sorts of talk over the spring and summer that, well, it's going to be a camp battle with him and McCown and Kessler, but really, it was going to be RG3. It was just a matter of when they officially decided to name him. By the way, we had a caller wanted to pass along something, and I started
digging. I don't know if I agree with that. Hold on, Jimmy.
Okay.
Tell me about the caller in a second. I don't know if I agree. I think that's what they wanted it to be. I think they absolutely wanted it to be exactly what you just said, and that is, this is going to be RG3, and he's going to come in here, he's going to seize the opportunity and make this an easy decision for us. That's what they wanted it to be. But I don't think it was just, it was always going to be as soon as they signed him. And the reason is because I think they just wanted to, not because of his skills. His skills are great. But, and I'm not saying he's all world, but I mean, his skills are obviously, there's a reason why the Redskins gave up that boatload of picks to move up to get him from the Rams, out of the Rams slot 4 years ago. But I think they wanted to see him come in and lead. I think they wanted to see,
yeah,
is he the cocky, pompous a-hole that so many people in Washington kind of alluded to him being? Or is he going to come in here humble I want to watch him get along with the players. I want to see how he reacts to Hugh. I want to see how he reacts to his other offensive coaches, position coaches, and so on, and see if he's the kind of leader we need him to be, or if his head is still somewhere else in terms of what he, you know, what he perceives,
right,
himself to be. So I think they certainly wanted it to be always just a matter of time it's going to be Robert. But I also think that Josh McCown wasn't traded for a reason. I think Josh McCown being a quality, not a star, obviously, but a quality starter in this league at the age of 37, they would have been okay if they had to go to battle with him starting and then maybe setting the table for Cody Kessler somewhere down the road. I don't know. But I think they wanted this to happen, but I don't think they were just going to say it. We're going to rubber stamp it, and it's definitely going to happen until they saw how he acted.
And that's a good point. That very well could be, you know, how it went down. And that's good. I got to give a tip of the cap then to the Browns coaching staff, you know, for taking that.
Yeah, I mean, that's my suspicion.
Yeah.
That's just how I think it went down.
And that very well could be. And again, if so, tip of the cap to the Browns coaching staff for not just automatically naming him the starter,
yeah,
and quote-unquote dragging this on. But at the end of the day, barring something funky, i.e. injury during OTAs or whatever, we were going to end up at this day, you know, eventually. But if that's how the Browns ended up doing it.
We got Petrak coming up here. What's,
yeah,
the caller story real quick?
The caller story was, and he just got the artist wrong. And eventually I found the correct one. And this is on the Pro Football Hall of Fame's website. This might be part of the field issue, because apparently this past Friday, as part of the festivities for the weekend, there was a Tim McGraw concert on the field. at the Hall of Fame Stadium that might have helped mess this up, or why some of the paint was the way it was. And he was throwing that out there, and I had to look it up. He had the wrong artist on it, but there was a Tim McGraw concert as part of the Hall of Fame festivities in Canton over the weekend.
Did they dump alcohol all over the paint to get made it change its properties or something?
I have no idea, but the concert was on the field, and the people would be, you know, sitting in the stands.
Yeah.
So maybe that had part to do with it, but I'm looking at it right now from the Hall of Fame's website itself, that back on Friday there was a Tim McGraw concert at the stadium.
Okay.
So maybe that contributed to part of it. Still no excuse.
No, it still doesn't make any sense to me either, until some scientist calls and tells me how a concert being on the field changes the properties of paint and whether or not it soaks into the artificial grass that's there so that players can get their cleats into it. Until somebody explains that to me, it's still not going to make sense. All right, let's get some sense out of the Griffin announcement that he is the head coach. Starting quarterback of the Cleveland Browns, as announced by head coach Hugh Jackson. We'll talk also about the inductions yesterday. We'll talk also about that embarrassment at the game last night, and much, much more. NFL style, Scott Petrak will join us coming up next. Later, Michael Phelps and 19, Ichiro and 3,000, A-Rod and A-Gon, and a little bit more on the NBA as well. So we have a big, full show for you. Still to come in the next 90 minutes. Stay where you are. Petrak coming next.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
There's no sense of belief. You come out every day for an opportunity. You know, I'm thankful to coach that he believes in me. They believe in me. And, you know, you just get ready for today's practice. Go out and get ready for Green Bay.
How and when did you find out?
We found out this morning. Coach just brought us into a meeting and told us the news.
Do you see any positives in having this done sooner than later?
I mean, it's like I said, it's always up to coach and what he wants to decide. I know all the other quarterbacks have done a lot to help me get to this point. And we got a great room, so I'm really appreciative of those guys, too.
A little bit from Robert Griffin III, new Browns starting quarterback, from his press conference after practice today, or at least in the middle of practice today. I liked what I heard from him. He went on to say that he's humbled just to be one of 32 starters in the National Football League. I like the sound of that, because humility is something that a lot of folks from D.C. will tell you was lacking in Robert Griffin, even as he started to lose favor with coaches and with his teammates and lose out to Kirk Cousins. Humility was lacking. I think I hear humility in his voice right now. Let's go out to Berea, where Scott Petrak joins us. Scott is a longtime Cleveland Browns beat writer. Talk a little bit about RG3, a little bit about the debacle down in Canton last night as well, and maybe even a little bit more. Scott Petrak, thanks for the time this afternoon. How are you, sir?
Good, Bobby. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, were you in that group there talking to Robert Griffin after the announcement was made, Scott?
I certainly was.
I'm hearing it from a distance, obviously. You were right up close. What I heard from that little tiny clip I played, plus the rest of it that I listened to off the air, I hear a guy who really sounds humbled. Sounds like he's not carrying that swagger that he did in Washington that a lot of people just did not like. He carried himself in a way that made him elevated, at least in his own mind, above other people, like he was always trying to personally craft his image, and that it got in the way of him doing his work and actually, you know, being one of the guys and leading the guys. That's what I heard from a distance. What can you tell us from up close?
Yeah, I would say that's pretty accurate, Bob. I think it's a balance for RG3 and maybe even a struggle. You know, I think when you're a Heisman Trophy winner and you're the number two pick in the draft and you set a bunch of historic rookie, you know, stats, your head gets big. And I think he was humbled just by kind of the demise and the fall of him in Washington. But I don't know if he truly kind of accepted that until he was cut and he re-signed, you know, when he signed with Cleveland. So he's going through that again. But as a quarterback, you can't be beaten down. So I think you have to find that kind of balance between humility and I'm still deserving of this job and I'm still one of the best guys in the league.
Yeah, and you know, that's the weird part about it. There is a balance, because you don't want to be beaten down and you don't want to be all, okay, I guess I'm not as good as I thought. Well, I'm not saying he needs to be that when I say humble, but you also can't be the guy who says, I feel like I'm the best quarterback in the league. You're not even starting on your own team and you're giving interviews and making statements about being the best quarterback going into last season when clearly, you know, he was not even, you know, the favorite on his team. It took a lot, I think, for Jay Gruden not to cut him before last season started, and yet here we sit. So that's the balance, I guess. Confidence, have some swagger that says, I'm the man, get behind me, boys, I'm going to lead you down the field, but also not, hey, I'm above you, and everybody really needs to kind of know their place.
Yeah, I think you have to think that you're the best guy in the league, but then you can't tell anybody that, and you can't act like it around your teammates. You just have to prove it.
Now tell me about the teammates. What are you hearing, all of the guys you talk to every day when you're covering this team at camp, what are you hearing about RG3? Are they excited about this, or are they like, hey, you know what, you can't tell me, you got to show me. Don't sing it, bring it.
I think there's a group of guys that are all in behind RG3, and I think part of that's the Baylor connections he has with Josh Gordon and Corey Coleman. Part of it's a guy like Joe Hayden embraced him when he arrived, and Robert Griffin went out of his way to be embraced, contacted teammates, set up events outside the facility. And then I think there's a portion of the team that is taking a wait-and-see attitude, but has been pleasantly surprised so far, because they heard all the stuff about RG3 in Washington. They knew all the baggage. The perception kind of preceded the player, and I think he's trying to overcome that. And really, the only way to overcome that is by working hard and by having success on the field. And he started to do that, so I think he's in a good spot. I don't think he's, you know, the number one leader of this team right now. I think he's got a way to go, but he's taking the necessary steps.
So when you say he's not the number one leader of this team, who is? Who are the leaders of this team, and does he recognize that? Does he fall in behind and kind of support the leadership of these guys that you're talking about?
I think he does, Bob. I mean, every time we talk to him, he mentions Joe Thomas and Andrew Hawkins, and I think Josh McCown fits in to that group. And you have Joe Hayden. There's guys that have been on this team a long time and have gone through a lot of losing and kind of earned their stripes here. Not that RG3 isn't a leader, and you need your quarterback to be, obviously. But I think he recognizes that it would have been wrong for him to come in and dominate the locker room day one, not even having been named a starter. So I think he recognized it was a process, and he's made progress, and now it's okay. How do I kind of join the team of Joe Thomas and Andrew Hawkins and Joe Hayden?
We're talking to Scott Petrak, who covers the Cleveland Browns for the Elyria Chronicle and the Medina Gazette out there in Berea right now. Talk a little bit about those guys. You know, it's good that he recognizes their leadership. Does Joe Thomas, Joe Hayden, other guys who are more respected veterans in that locker room and on that field, do they kind of, you know, what is their view of Robert Griffin? Are they talking about him? What camp do they fall in?
No, they're saying good things. And Joe Hayden's raved about him for a long time now. And Joe Thomas... who has seen so many quarterbacks come through here and be hyped and praised, that I think he's got a natural, you know, skepticism. I think he's taken RG3 for what he's worth and said, okay, this guy has worked hard. He's come in. He's kept his nose clean. He's playing better by the day. I can get behind that. So I do think Robert's done what he's needed to do. But he doesn't, you know, I think he's got a personality that's just a little quirky, and it takes some guys some time to warm up to it. And, you know, he didn't get here till April. You know, it's only a couple of months. They had the summer off. So I think it's just kind of, it's going to take a while for him to become, you know, maybe that number one guy, the face of the franchise. I just think he's not there yet, and that's to be expected.
What's in that quirkiness? Because, you know, when I listen to him, and again, I'm not next to him, and I'm not talking to the other guys like you do, but he's so incredibly intelligent. You can tell that, yeah, just listening to him. He's a very, very smart guy. And when you hear a guy as well-spoken as he is and as intelligent as he obviously is, you kind of just want to say, yeah, I like that. I like the way he speaks. But yet it rubs some people the wrong way because of, I guess, as you put it, that quirkiness. What is it in his personality that makes people kind of like go, I don't know if I like what I hear?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, Bob. I don't know if I can put my finger on it completely. I think part of it is the perception from Washington that,
yeah,
he had a lot of me in him. He talked about himself an awful lot.
Yeah.
That sometimes he tried to deflect the blame. And he might not have been wrong, but I think it didn't play well. It doesn't play well when a quarterback, you know, blames the offensive line for sacks. And for whatever reason that is. You know, if Tom Brady did it, we'd all say, oh, he's just trying to get the best out of guys. But maybe Robert, he'd rubbed people the wrong way or defended people, so they jumped on those kind of statements. And I just think from a personality standpoint, you know, some guys are outgoing, they're gregarious, they're easy to like right away. Joe Hayden's one of those guys. I just think Robert's a little more introverted. He's not a big, showy kind of guy, and that's fine, but maybe it just takes a little bit longer to get to know him as opposed to a guy like, you know, Joe Hayden or Danny Shelton, who comes in bubbling and talking to everybody.
Last thing, Scott, on quarterbacks. Is there a reason why Josh McCown is still here? There was all of that talk about, of course there is a reason, let me rephrase. is the reason that Josh McCown is still here, despite all of that talk about Dallas being interested in him in a trade to be the backup to Tony Romo, is it because maybe Hugh Jackson, maybe the brain trust Sashi Brown, they don't necessarily buy 100% into Robert, and if he falters or flops or something else, they got to have somebody other than a, you know, just a daisy fresh rookie like Cody Kessler to go to?
Yeah, I think it's layered, Bob. I think reason number one is that if Robert gets hurt, which he's gotten hurt, you know, just the last 3 years, or he's healthy last year and didn't play, but he got hurt the 3 previous years, then let's say that happens week one, they're not ready to put Cody Kessler in, and he's not ready. And I don't think Austin Davis is the answer. So you need Josh McCown, so you're saying we're not giving up on the season week one if something disastrous happens. I also think that Josh McCown brings value to this team. Not only can he fill in and play well, I think from a leadership standpoint, from a locker room, from a game planning standpoint, he has tremendous value. And then the last part is the Browns set a price for him, and Dallas wasn't willing to make to match that price. So if they said, okay, we need a third-round pick, we think that's worth the risks of giving up Josh McCown, Dallas wouldn't meet that. Doesn't mean they won't change. Doesn't mean the price won't be dropped, but that's where we are right now.
Let's talk about what happened over the first week of camp. I read your piece, 5 thoughts from training camp after 1 week and a couple of scrimmages, of course, down there at Ohio Stadium, too, on Saturday. Let's talk a little bit about it. Number one, you say the Browns need to play somebody else. Is it just because, you know, of the raw, I'm tired of hitting my teammates kind of a thing, I'm not getting any new looks here, or guys champing at the bit just to get some fresh meat? What are your thoughts?
To me, well, first of all, there's a monotony of camp, you know, and you play the same guys over and over, and it gets old. But to me, it's more important to see how guys like RG3, Terrell Pryor, and Corey Coleman, how they do against somebody else. You know, I don't think you get a true gauge of Corey Coleman when he's playing Justin Gilbert, and you don't know how good Justin Gilbert is. Joe Hayden hasn't been out there because of the ankle. So I think if you go to Green Bay and they play NFL-caliber corner in Green Bay, you get a better sense of where Corey Coleman, and especially Terrell Pryor, where they stack up in the NFL.
Well, number two on your list is about Robert Griffin, so let's talk about that. How does he and Corey Coleman and everybody else look against the same competition? Even, again, your point is well taken. Hayden is not there, and Justin Gilbert is Justin Gilbert, but how does he look and how have they looked, particularly on Friday and Saturday with those scrimmages?
Yeah, Bob, I think there is a sense of optimism, and there should be, specifically offensively. The way Robert threw the ball Friday and Saturday was really good. He made every throw. He was accurate with great touch on deep balls. He threw plenty of deep outs and comebacks. He made strides to me the last 3-4 days of practice after a real inconsistent start, in my opinion, to the spring and summer. And Corey Coleman, he would flash every day, and you go, okay, we're seeing why they took him at number 15 overall. And then he comes out Friday and makes 3 tremendous plays on deep balls. You go, hey, if this even carries over partially, then maybe they hit on the first, you know, have the first successful first-round pick in years, and that's the only way this franchise is ever going to get better.
Yeah, that's kind of an amazing thing to say. They have had so many first-round picks that they missed on. It's been painful, and it slowed their development from, you know, laughing stock of the league into something respectable, let alone something in contention. So that's a great point. Who else other than Coleman has looked good? Give us just kind of the sense of the rookies that you've seen. And again, I know they're going to really start proving themselves or not when we get into Friday in the first preseason game and that sort of thing, but just based on the scrimmaging they've done.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's a young team, but you got the 4 rookie receivers. The other 3 guys have all shown up. Rashard Higgins, I think he's smooth. He's a 5th rounder. Ricardo Lewis, he's got the best size of any of the rookies. He's about 6'2", 215, fast, and he hadn't really shown up a whole lot. And then Friday and Saturday, I saw him make some catches and go, okay, maybe this guy's starting to get it. Jordan Payton is the other 5th round receiver, and he looks comfortable, even though he missed all the spring. He had to stay at UCLA. Then you go around the field. You got Spencer Drango, who's a 5th-round tackle, getting time at right tackle, rookie. You know, so this team is going to be a young team, and we could see 4 or 5 rookies contribute on offense. And if they contribute during the regular season, then all of a sudden Hugh Jackson is starting to build something.
What about Terrell Pryor? Last time we spoke, about a week or so ago, he had made a great catch in practice, and he and Griffin chest bumped one another, and it was looking great and all that sort of thing. But that's one play, that's one moment in time, and it wasn't live like scrimmaging. So now that you've seen him a little bit more, I don't know how many catches he's had or how he's looked. What about Terrell Pryor? Is there still reason for optimism that he's growing into something that could be serviceable?
Yeah, there certainly is, Bob. On Saturday down at Ohio State, I think he had four or five catches. He caught a 75-yarder from McCown when he just ran by the defensive back. He leaped over a cornerback, Kaywan Williams, in the end zone for a 5-yard fade touchdown. He continues to show up, and every time we talk to him, and I think what's a key thing, and I talked to him again about it Saturday, is last year he wasn't ready for the amount of running that you do as a receiver. And I think we talked about this a little bit last week,
but now he
seems healthy. Yeah, he seems healthy. I think he's going to have a full preseason. And that's what you need if you're trying to make this switch. You can't be in and out of the lineup.
We're talking to Scott Petrak, a little Browns preview here after they just had a scrimmage down there at Ohio Stadium. What'd they draw, about 40,000? That place must have looked empty with 40,000 inside a football
field. I know,
110. But the Browns, a couple of days of scrimmaging on Friday and Saturday. They were off yesterday. Where's Josh Gordon, by the way, in his recovery from his quad?
I'm telling you right now, Bob, I'm about 30 yards away from watching him do those exercises where they got the big, like, ropes and to strengthen your arms.
Right.
He's got a hoodie on. He's trying to drop some weight, and he's going through the routine with the trainers. I don't think this week, just because they only have three practices before Green Bay, but I think the hope is next week you get him on the field.
Okay, and then let's get to the other. Well, actually, let's get into the trenches first, real quick. Just your thoughts, Cameron Irving. You said he's missed 3 days of practice. Even when he is healthy, he's going to have a very tough job. First of all, Alex Mack was a great center, one of the best in the NFL, I think, over the course of the last five years or so. And Cameron Irving, we know from a couple of infamous video clips of being pushed over and run over. Is this going to work with him at the center position?
Well, he's back today, which is a good sign. I don't know, Bob. I skepticism. There's no other. I'm not sure there's another choice. You could slide John Greco over and stick in another journeyman at right guard, I suppose. But they need Cameron Irving to work out. He was another one of those number one picks that hasn't come to fruition yet. I know he's only, you know, it's only his second year, but he was not what they had hoped for out of the number 19 pick last year for sure. They need him. They need him in the middle, and they need somebody to hold down the right tackle spot. If not, those moves, letting Mack and letting Mitchell Schwartz go, will only look worse, especially if RG3 shows some promise. There was no need to let those guys go. You might be able to kind of fast-track that rebuilding process.
And that's my concern is about RG3. Is, you know, if the offensive line isn't up to snuff, this guy's going to be running for his life back there, and one of two things is going to happen, or maybe both. One, he's going to get hurt, which, of course, he's been prone to do. Or two, he's going to be running around and making poor decisions quickly because he's not ready and he doesn't have the time to make his reads and his progressions and do all the things he's working with Hugh Jackson on doing, and it's going to frustrate him, and the numbers are going to be bad, and picks are going to happen, and people are going to turn on him, and the entire thing might be, you know, might be upset before it ever gets a chance to really get going.
Yeah, those are all valid concerns. I would say that the hope is Hugh Jackson can manage all that. And I know that's a lot of pressure on the coach or a lot of responsibility, but I feel Hugh is taking that all on his shoulders. And in his mind, he says, I need to protect RG3. I need to run the ball to take pressure off him. And if I can do those things, we have a chance to let him kind of slowly grow back into who he was. Now, you know, you need the players to do it, but I believe Hugh Jackson will have a plan. Now he just needs these guys to go out and execute it. So I think that's another reason why there's so much, I don't know if pressure is the right word, but Hugh's responsible for so much, you know, kind of re-nurturing Josh Gordon back into the fold and growing Terrell Pryor and saving RG3. He's got a lot on his plate for, you know, I know he's been a head coach once before, but this is his first year in the pressure cooker at Cleveland.
Scott, last thing on the offense, Duke Johnson or Isaiah Crowell?
Yeah, I think Crowell's going to be the number one guy, Bob. It wouldn't shock me if he ran for 1,200 yards. I think you're going to see Duke all over the place, some wide receiver, playing some slot, and then be that change of pace to Crowell.
Last night, the biggest painting snafu on a football field since some dude in a Kansas City Kansas City Stadium in the Snickers commercial painted the word chefs. What an embarrassment last night. How on earth? And were you down there by chance? Did you go down to Canton for that?
I was not. I was not.
Okay, so you watched it from afar. Your thought, I mean,
yep.
Scott, I've never seen anything like this before. And they're going to try to put all the blame on Canton and on the Hall of Fame and those who are in the game. And this is an NFL thing. Everything the NFL does has to be inspected by and passed by the National Football League. And they seem to be just ducking for cover so that the blame for them, or the blame, I should say, doesn't fall on them. How can something like this happen?
Yeah, I don't have a great answer for that, Bob. My impression is I'm just so sad for Canton. That's like, you know, that's their Super Bowl. You know, that whole town revolves around that weekend, and it was a good weekend. Brett Favre, Tony Dungy, they had big names down there and a big drawing. And for it to end on such a sour note, I just feel bad for that community. And I think you're right. I think the NFL, they control everything. So the fact that that happened, you know, I think the blame has to go to them.
I'm just trying to figure out how something like that happens. You know what I mean? Because I'm guessing that every stadium doesn't just go to their own local Sherwin-Williams or someplace and order up some Krylon. There's one place I would imagine that all NFL stadiums gets their paint from for their field. I'm sure the NFL probably has contracts, the official field paint of so-and-so. How the heck do you buy taffy-style paint that ends up becoming as hard as a parking lot, they said?
Yeah, I don't know that. I really don't know that answer, Bob. I don't know if some of it's different because, you know, because the Browns would have it every week, right? So they do it. They paint the field 10 times a year. Canton probably does it once a year. You know, is that why it happened? Did it happen because they waited too long to put it on because they had the induction ceremony Saturday night?
Right.
Did enough time to let the paint dry and then that. What I read, they tried to fast forward the drying process and that created the havoc. But it's just such a bad look.
Yeah, it really is. And as you say, it's really unfortunate for the people of Canton. And also all the people who came down there for the ceremony, you know, and then stayed an extra day to watch the game and had an extra day of hotel, et cetera. And then they bought tickets. And I know they said they're going to refund the money for the tickets, but I'm sure they're probably not going to cover everybody's expenses for their hotel and all the other things they did. It's really just a bad look, you know, for the Hall and for the NFL. But again, the NFL passing the buck is nothing new. It's just very disappointing to me. Whose speech did you like the most yesterday at the induction ceremony?
You know, Bob, I was down at Ohio State the whole time. I did not watch the Browns. I did not get to see much of it at all. I heard the Favre clips, and I've always had a soft spot for him, but I did not get to hear many of them.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because what Favre did, according to Favre, is he didn't write a speech. He said, "I'm going to wing it like I did my entire career." and you know, and you and I have differed on this a little bit through the years. You've had a soft spot. I've always kind of had a little bit of a, I don't know, I don't want to say an animosity toward him in any way. He certainly didn't do anything wrong other than those last few years of retire. Okay, I'm not retiring. Okay, I'm out. I'm in. Screwing with teams and then making them make decisions on what to do with him. Three different teams involved in that. But I was telling Jim at the top of the show today, you know, I feel like he's right when he says, I didn't really prepare a lot of stuff. I just winged it. I just kind of ad-libbed it. I just kind of played it off the cuff. And I feel like as great as his career was, 20 years of some of the best numbers ever, could have been better and would have been better and maybe had another championship if he hadn't just winged it and played it off the cuff and tried to make these wild, crazy plays with the clock, with heat bearing down on him. And some of the things he did, I feel like may have cost him a little bit more, you know, throughout his career.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I mean, I don't think you have to look much past that NFC Championship game in Minnesota where he threw the pick when they were going down to kick the winning field goal to get him to the Super Bowl. You know, that was a dumb decision, and he made plenty of those. But I think he's one of those guys, the further you get away from his career, the better it kind of looks, not just because of the numbers, but because he left such a favorable impression. Everybody can kind of think of a game or two where they watched Brett Favre and were amazed. And I think that kind of sticks in your head maybe more than not throwing any interceptions.
Tony Dungy made it on his third year of eligibility, third time being a finalist. I'm trying to remember exactly how it worked out. But any problem with Tony Dungy? One Super Bowl. Only one Super Bowl championship. Obviously, you know, I think he had a great winning percentage in his career. He's like a 66% of his games as a head coach. Any problems with Tony Dungy getting?
I don't, Bob. I think he's a guy that changed the league on a couple levels. You know, hiring as many African-American assistant coaches as he did. He's the first kind of African-American coach to have his own coaching tree and a successful coaching tree. And he's the kind of guy that the whole league gravitates toward. You know, he's had a career as a player. He's had a career as an assistant, as a head coach. Now he's a broadcaster, and he's so well-respected. I think I might have told you last year, he'd be the number, if I were hiring a coach right now, he'd be my number one candidate of anybody I could hire in a week.
I would agree. I would agree with that. That is very well said. He's royalty. In my mind, he's NFL royalty. The only reason I ask is I heard some people kind of questioning the candidacy of so on and so forth, other coaches who may have had just as good of a reason to be inducted right now than he does, other one-time Super Bowl champions or two-time champions in the case of like Tom Flores, who is not in, those kinds of people. So some are saying, does Tony Dungy get in because of his coaching acumen and the success that he had, or is he in because of the trailblazer status, because he did hire so many African-American coaches who then went on to become head coaches and really paved the way for a lot of other, you know, black coaches to get opportunities in the National Football
League? Sure. Well, even if it is a combination of the two, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, well, you know, if you think about it, there's a contributor aspect of the Hall of Fame as well. Not that he would be, you know, in that category, but there, you're right. You know, first of all, his success, he did win a championship. Excuse me. He did win 66% of his games. And then you add to it this other. As long as it's not one or the other, I think if you add them together, that's what makes a Hall of Fame coach. And like I said, I don't think there's ever been anybody in the league who's ever said anything bad about Tony Dungy. He's NFL royalty, and it is a great thing to see. Scott, I didn't realize it, but we're already at 4:02. I blew past our news and our top of the hour sports break, so I apologize for keeping you over. But great conversation. I enjoyed every second of it. Keep up the great work. We'll chat. You know what? Let's check in next Monday if we could and look back at the first preseason game from Friday. Sound all right?
Sounds good, Bob. Thanks.
We'd love to. Thank you, Scott. Scott Petrak joining us right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. All right, my apologies for blowing past the clock. Jim Cushlin, how come you didn't remind me? Usually you yell at me long before I go this far past. So let's take that time out now and come back and get some phone calls right here on ESPN 106.5.
The 2-0. Each row to right and deep. Back goes Parra to the wall, and it's off the wall. 3,000 is in right field, and Ichiro is racing for third, and he's done it. He's climbed the mountain, a triple, and he has arrived at 3,000.
Baseball history made today.
This is a tough day. I love this game, and I love this team. And today, I'm saying goodbye to both. This is also a proud day. I was 18 when I broke into the big leagues. I never thought I could play for 22 years. At 18, I just wanted to make the team. I want to thank the Steinbrenner family for giving me this opportunity. No athlete ever ends his career or her career the way you want to. We all want to keep playing forever, but it doesn't work that way. Accepting the end gracefully is part of being a professional athlete. Saying goodbye may be the hardest part of the job, but that's what I'm doing today.
All this excitement's got me wanting to call Ed Werder and spread the word again. I was pretty certain at 14 years old of what I was going to do in my future, and that was I was going to be the next Roger Staubach or Archie Manning or Joe Montana. Of course, I didn't have many choices. It was football, baseball, or bust. For me, I had dreamed of playing the NFL, believe me, way more than I thought about my schoolwork. I thought about being Archie Manning, running around throwing underhand passes. I thought about being my childhood favorite, Roger Staubach, throwing it to Preston Pearson or Drew Pearson, handing it off to Tony Dorsett, being Kenny Stabler coming out of the tunnel. I'd thought of those things so many times, but I never thought of the Hall of Fame until that moment. So a new goal had entered my mind then and there. And I said to myself, I will make it to the Hall of Fame.
You know, I find out about it at 5:30, and we'll look at it. We'll make sure it never happens again. But it's one of those things for us. You know, there was enough doubt in the mind of both teams. We think we might be able to remediate it, even if there was a delay in the game for up to an hour. But frankly, if there's some question amongst team personnel or the players, you know, this is the Pro Football Hall of Fame. You know, we stand for respect for players, not just Hall of Famers, but every guy that ever played this game has an archive in that place. So I think it's a huge expression of public safety.
Great. Googly, boogly.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
David Baker of the Hall of Fame, Roger Goodell, all joining hands to say after the field was painted poorly for last night's Hall of Fame game to say,
great googly moogly.
One of the greatest commercials, or at least one of my most memorable commercials of all time. Absolutely love that. My goodness gracious, what a mess the NFL has on its hands. Welcome as we continue hour number two of the extravaganza underway now. Right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, a lot of good stuff in that montage. How about Ichiro's 3,000? Ichiro would make his 3,000th career-based hit in the major leagues. And by the way, how many is that overall when you count the Japanese league now?
Oh, gosh, I'd have to get the number again. It's more than Pete Rose's all-time. We know that.
Well, he broke that. He broke that a long time ago.
Right.
You know, all-time is all-time, you know, hit king number. But I think even he said, you know, it doesn't count as much, you know, because of Pete. But my goodness. I mean, you have to ask yourself, in all seriousness, where does Ichiro rank in terms of just being the all-time greatest batsman in baseball history? And when I say batsman, instead of hitter, there's a reason for that, obviously. Because there are guys who are great hitters, and I think of great hitters as being, as being guys who can get the base knock you need when you need it, but guys who can drive it out of the park when you need it. Guys who can move a guy over when you need it. Guys who can be the run-producing, you know, number three hitter in your order who is always, you know, going to hit 310, 320, but also drive in 80, 90, 100 runs, maybe more. You know, there's a difference between hitters and batsmen. Batsmen would include the likes of, just in my opinion, would include the likes of, you know, Tony Gwynn, Wade Boggs, Ichiro Suzuki, guys who were never going to be power hitters, and maybe even Pete Rose, but never going to be power hitters or giant run producers, that kind of thing, but are just like magicians. They wave the bat. Rod Carew, they wave the bat around like it's you know, like it's some sort of a magic wand, where they can always put it where it needs to be to drive that ball into the outfield if that's what has to happen. Or to bounce a three-hopper up the middle for that RBI single to win the game. Just to start off, you know, a ninth-inning rally, I got to get on, to slap one through, you know, the left side of the infield if you're a left-handed hitter, or the right side if you're a righty. Just things like that. He's just one of the great batsmen of all time. He might be the greatest batsman of all time. Can you think of it in those terms, Jim? Did you find the number?
Yeah, first of all, yeah, I found the number. 1,278 when he played in Japan. So if you combine Major League and his time in Japan, 4,278.
Compared to Pete Rose's all-time MLB record of 4,256.
Right.
So he passes him up, but obviously we know that Japanese pitching isn't exactly the best in the world. It is maybe second best in the world. Look at the number of Japanese pitchers who have come over here and done great things in the United States and in MLB.
Well, that's the other side note real quick before we continue on this, that you know, this marker is something to really truly make note of, is because Ichiro really was also the guy that opened the door to all of us here stateside that said, you know, maybe occasionally you can find one of those Asian bats to be okay and not just the pitchers. He was really the first position player to come over. Before that, was just pitchers. And ever since then, whether they're Japanese or South Korean, like former Indian Shin-Soo Choo, in many ways, Ichiro opened that door, because a lot of major league teams at the time were very standoffish about a position player from Japan at the time.
While you're on that subject, name some other Japanese position players who have come over.
Let's see. Just off the top of my head.
I mean, you mentioned Chu, who's Korean. One there. That's a great example there. And I know there are others, but I'm trying to think of who else.
Nori Aoki is, I believe, one. He's bounced around with a couple teams most recently, with the Royals last year or two. I forget where he is now. Names blanking on me, for some reason. Really bad on me. The power hitter from Japan who played for the Yankees in recent years.
I know who you're talking about.
Right. So there's another
one.
But
I'm drawing a blank on it too.
Yeah, bad on us. We're drawing a blank on the name, but Hideki Matsui.
There's
another one.
And that's not even recent years, really. He's been out for a while now.
Yeah, he has. That was more, when I say recent, I mean like 5-6+ years ago. But
Hideki Matsui, that's a good one. That's a good one. I think he last played, I want to say around 2012, 4 years ago at least, maybe more. I'm not positive. But okay, my point being that
Kaz Matsui was another one. He played for 6 years. I believe he was a catcher. I know he was an infielder, played for the Mets and Houston for a couple years. And just a couple of, I'm sure I could, you know, if I took the time, there could be more I could find. But really, for position players, Ichiro was the first one, and by how good he was when he first came over, because there's always that talk at baseball, well, watch the age 27 year, that's usually their best. Ichiro was age 27 when he came over to the Mariners for that 0-1 season where he won Rookie of the Year and the MVP, but there were basically no position players. It was only the pitchers, your Hideo Nomos, yep, and the rest before then, and he opened the door legitimately for them to come over on the position player side.
Godzilla, by the way. Godzilla was what they called Hideki Matsui.
That's right.
That was his nickname. My point to all of that, the reason I asked who else was there, is because not only was Ichiro a trendsetter or a trailblazer or whatever you want to call it for Asian players to come here, he was so unique in his talent that there weren't even that many that were even able to follow his lead. I mean, in other words, they still don't have a ton of position players coming from the Asian ball clubs, or particularly or leagues, particularly Japan, the way they do pitchers.
Right.
And that just underscores Ichiro's greatness, that he came over here and didn't just bounce around. Or, for example, Godzilla Matsui, Hideki Matsui, he had 175 home runs in his career in Major League Baseball. 175 home runs, batted 282, total RBI 760. That's after hitting 332 in Japan. So you add those together and you have, what is that, .507, if I did that right. That's 507 career home runs. So he had the vast majority of his success in Japan, 332
right,
of his 507, as opposed to Ichiro, who's, you know, what'd you say was 1278?
1278 in Japan in 9 seasons.
And 3,000 now, of course,
right,
in Major League Baseball. So he had the vast majority of it here. Nobody has come over here and had the kind of success that Ichiro has, even somebody as great as Matsui. And he was a very, very big player for the Yankees in the decade of the 2000s. So I just want to pay all the respect in the world to Ichiro Suzuki. By the way, who I did not like when he came up. Or came over, I should say. I guess I didn't like the whole, hey, he's a pro, he's not really Rookie of the Year kind of thing. And I know there was a big battle about that. And there was one writer who was actually in Cleveland, was the one writer who stopped him from being a unanimous Rookie of the Year winner. And he just made the argument that he's not a rookie. He might be his first year here, but he's 27 and he's played for the last 6 years or whatever it was.
Nine
years?
Yeah, he started age 18 in 1992 with that Oryx team in Japan.
So he played 9 years in Japan professionally. That's not a rookie in my book. But I didn't like that. I also didn't like the whole, you know, he goes by his first name. Why doesn't it say Suzuki on his back instead of Ichiro? I mean, what is this? This isn't Little League where you put Ben on the back of your shirt or Stevie or you know, Susan or whatever. There was just something that just annoyed me about the whole thing. But I got to tell you, he wore and wore and wore on me and won me over in relatively short order. And he has had a career that has been one of the greats of anybody who's ever stepped in a batter's box. When I say batsman again, I mean, he's already the all-time single-season base hit leader.
The 262 in 2004, yep.
That's right. You know, and again, I'm not saying his 4278 trumps Pete Rose's 4256, because I was always a Pete Rose fan too.
Yep.
But doggone it, it's so fitting that his 3,000th hit was a triple, because his game was built on putting the ball where somebody isn't and then using his speed to get extra bases, which he did. He was a 10-time All-Star, Rookie of the Year, and MVP. And to do all of that, again, coming over here at the age of 27, is just simply amazing to me. So just massive respect for Ichiro Suzuki, and one of the best all-time of the bat in the sand. Like I said, I don't care who you are. I think of Gwynn Boggs, Carew come to mind for me. Who else were just some of the guys? And maybe you can tell us at 866-240-1065. Who were some of the hitters who weren't really power guys, but just the guy you wanted if you needed a base knock? This is the guy you want at the plate. If you need a home run, somebody else. You need to get to get a rally started, or you need to drive in the winning run from second, or you need to move a runner over or whatever. A guy who just waved that bat around like a wand. It was Ichiro, Boggs, Carew, Tony Gwynn, and I'm trying to think. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's the four. Maybe those are the four that you think of. You know, I'll tell you another one. And it might sound like homerism, because Jim, you and I are both Cleveland fans, but Omar Vizquel belongs in that conversation. Not to the greatness level of Suzuki, but not far behind either. Omar Vizquel ended his career, how many hits shy of 3,000?
Let me look up
like
his
a couple dozen. I mean, I think he was in 29 something territory, wasn't he? Just a couple dozen hit shots.
It's got to be close to that. Hang on, I'm bringing it up right here. 2877.
2877. Okay, so 123 shy of 3,000 for his career.
Yep.
Again, not a guy. Although he could occasionally pop the ball out of the ballpark. And he could occasionally drive, you know, bang one off the wall and run. He was such a great smart base runner, too. But that's another guy, when I think of just a great batsman, different than hitters, batsman. And Omar Vizquel is one. Anybody else you can think of that fits that bill? Look at Tigers history. Look at anybody else that just kind of...
I mean, the list you just started is definitely, you know, minus Vizquel is the top of the list. Your Boggs, your Carew, your Ichiro, your Pete Rose. That's the without question, and Tony Gwynn. That's your, those five guys right there. That is definitely the top echelon of what we're kind of talking about here.
Yeah.
In terms of the hitters who may not necessarily have been power hitters, but, if you could bat that guy nine times in a row, you sure as heck would do it. In terms of Ichiro, and I'll admit, you know, I didn't like him at first either, but it wasn't for the reasons you were stating. Mine was a simple, straight-up homerism. That was that 0-1 Mariners team, and especially that playoffs.
116 win
that
team.
Was the 116-1 that the Indians lost to in the first round. I think Ichiro hit like 500 over the course of those five games, as that was the year he stormed into the league. But honestly, for me, Bob, he grew on me after a while, because when you watch him hit, and by the way, funny quirk, you're talking about his game and how he played it and how the triple is so symbolic. That's part of the reason he's a left-handed hitter. The story goes, if I'm saying it right, his dad more or less taught him to hit left-handed instead, because he's naturally a right-hander. But the principle was, well, that way after you swing and make contact, we're going to have you a step and a half ahead to first base. It was that kind of style of play that he was taught back in Japan back in the day. And the thing that grew on me over time is I looked at the way he played, and specifically how he hit, and beating out infield singles and all that kind of stuff. And I really view him with a bat as basically this generation's type of Pete Rose player. I look at, you know, forget all his off the field stuff and when he was done with his playing days. We're not talking about that Pete Rose stuff. Yeah. We're talking about on the field when he played. When you look at Pete Rose and Ichiro, I look at two guys and I say to myself, that's how baseball is supposed to be played.
Yeah, I would agree. And I would extend that, not that it really plays into this discussion because we're talking offense, because he got his 3,000th hit, but look at the way he played defense too. Ichiro Suzuki was a terrific right fielder. He was an all-star not just because of his bat. He played a great right field, had a very, very strong arm, could hose guys. That's another thing with Ichiro. I'm just looking for more names of best pure hitters, and I'm just looking at a few different people's opinions. And some names are coming up, and some of them are more singles hitters, greatest singles hitters of all time. Like I mentioned, you know, Ichiro Suzuki, Pete Rose. You know, Pete himself.
Technically speaking, here's another one. This is kind of local, but this was in the era when power hitting just wasn't a thing. Ty Cobb.
Well, yeah.
Forget his garbage and his personality, but that's a guy who was a magician with the bat, no doubt.
Pete himself, we didn't even mention Pete in this, as we talked about Gwynn, Boggs, Carew, Suzuki, and then I threw in Vizquel. Pete Rose, of his 4,256 hits, 3,215 were singles.
That's nuts when you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, he was not a power guy. He was just, I'm going to get the ball in play, and I'm going to beat plays out. That's, of course, I got Charlie Hustle. I'm going to beat, the ball to first base and all the things that he did. Just a few other names here that I can, try to punch a couple more of these up here. These are just considered pure hitters, not necessarily big boppers, long ball hitters. Joe Mauer, talking about current guys. Miguel Cabrera, although Cabrera has got the power also, but he's just a guy who doesn't strike out much. He just has such a great command of the plate. You know, you say pitchers have a command of the strike zone, a command of the plate, knowing where it is and what kind of swing to put on it. If you need to go that way or if you need to pull it, if you need to go up the middle, if you need to do this, that, or the other thing. That's Miguel Cabrera, too. Now, he'll get lost in this discussion. because of the power that he has as well. Victor Martinez is another guy considered in that. And this is, I'm just looking at different guys' opinions on ESPN and so on. Dustin Pedroia. Albert Pujols, again, a guy with tremendous plate discipline, the ability to put the ball wherever it has to be, but also the ability to just bang it out of the yard. One of the great home run hitters of all time. So there's, I'm looking for some other names. Let's get some help from the listeners. 866-240-1065. See if anybody else has any ideas on this. Tim in Toledo. Tim, Ichiro Suzuki just got 3,000. One of the great bat handlers of all time. Who else you got?
Hey, Bob. Derek Jeter.
Derek Jeter. That's a great point. I don't know how we gloss over the captain. That's a great point.
He's got like 3,400 total hits, mm-hmm. and I think he only hit 20 home runs in one season.
Yeah, I think you're right. Now what made Jeter so good, as we all know, you know, for the four championship teams he was on, is his ability to do that in the clutch. And it didn't matter what was needed. If he needed to bang a double off the wall in the eighth inning to take to score the go-ahead run, he'll do it. And if he needed to poke one through the right side, he would do it. If he needed to lay one down and beat it out, he could do that too. That's a great point. Derek Jeter doesn't get enough credit.
Yeah, Jeter had 260 career home runs. He only crossed 20 twice, 1999 and 2004.
Do you happen to have the stat that I pulled out for Pete and for Ichiro, the number of his base hits that were singles?
Yeah, hang on. I was just on that page. Let me go back to that real quick.
That's a great way to look at it, again, when we're just talking about guys who put it in play.
Here you go. Here you go, Bob. The all-time singles list, guys. Pete Rose, these are just singles.
Yes.
Pete Rose, 32-15. Ty Cobb, 30-53. Eddie Collins, 26-43. Cap Anson, 26-14. And Jeter's fifth, 25-95.
There you go.
In terms of singles.
Your point, Tim. That's
and Ichiro is seventh, by the way, 24-44 for singles for a career.
It's a great
poll.
Yes, sir, Tim.
Us Yankee fans always have the answer.
Hey, you know what? When you're right, man. I don't like the Yankees. Yes. I don't like the Yankees, and I don't like most of their fans, present company not included. But when a fan is right, man, I don't care who you root for, you're right. And Jeter's got to be in that discussion, absolutely.
If you doubt me, just ask the Indians after this season. Goodbye.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it. Let's go to Chuck in Perrysburg. Hey, Chuck, you're on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, Bob. How you doing, guys?
Good. Real good.
I'm thinking just because, you know, watching him grow up when I was, you know, in his heyday, one of the best first basemen that's not in the Hall of Fame, but great hitter, Johnny Mattingly.
Wow. That's another good pull. Another Yankee that we didn't really think about. Mattingly's ability to put the ball in play, to wield that bat for power if need be, but also just to get that, you know, just to get that timely hit in the right spot. That's another good one. I don't have his numbers. Jimmy, can you pull up Donnie Baseball?
Sure. Numbers? As I'm pulling up Don Mattingly, I'll throw out another one as I'm scanning the singles list. Paul Molitor. He was never a power hitter. 2,366 singles for his career. And hang on, let me get you the Mattingly numbers.
Yeah, I forgot about Paul Molitor. That's a great one. That's a great example.
And, of course, he's giving the Indians fits right now as being manager of that Twins team that the Indians can't seem to beat.
They can't even touch them for some strange reason. Although the Indians aren't touching anybody. They've lost five of their last seven in the game. In the division, I should say, is now two apart, the Indians and the Tigers.
Now, Don Mattingly had three 30-plus homer seasons, 222 for his career, 2,153 total hits for his career, but he was a 307 lifetime hitter.
Right.
So there's
a 300 hitter and not in the Hall of Fame. I mean, defensively, one of the best first basemen to play the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, really good call there. Really good call on Molitor. I mean, Donnie Baseball and on Paul Molitor, both you guys. Donnie Baseball was one of the best defensive first basemen. I don't have it in front of me, but I know he won gold gloves.
Right, he was what, like an 8 or 9-time gold glove winner?
That's what I was going to ask. I don't know how many it was, but he was certainly a gold glove first baseman as well as being you know, one of the best hitters of his generation.
He won nine gold gloves.
Right. Yeah, how is he now? What's Mattingly's
lifetime
batting average? What's his lifetime batting average?
307.
Yeah.
307. How many home runs and RBIs?
222 lifetime homers, 1099 on the RBI front. He led the league in RBIs in 85, won a batting title in 84, led the league in doubles three straight years, 84 through 86. That was obviously his main heyday there.
Yeah, I got to agree with you. I got to agree with you.
Year.
That's a Hall of Fame career as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, nobody even really talks about him as being, a finalist or a guy who's, you know, who's been snubbed.
Well, Cooperstown's the hardest Hall of Fame in the world to get into.
Yes, it is.
And from what I, you know, never meeting the man, but everybody, you know, people that have known him, you know, they say he's not the nicest guy in the world, but look at a lot of these guys. They're not the nicest guys in the world, and they're Hall of Famers.
I don't care. I don't care how nice somebody is. I really don't. I mean,
their stats speak for themselves.
Exactly. You know, I mean, not, you know, Ty Cobb is legendary for being a jerk. You know, Barry Bonds
right.
is not in, not because he's a nice guy, but because of the steroids. Don Mattingly didn't do anything to cheat the game.
Nope.
If he's not a pleasant guy, so be it. It doesn't matter. It's what did you do when you were in between the lines? When you were in between the chalk, you know, that's all that really matters to me. I agree with you. That's a great answer. A great answer. Thank you for so much for the call, Chuck. I appreciate it. I'm looking at another guy. I'll go to the phones in a second here. This is another guy that I consider to be one of those great all-time batsmen, but he'll never get credit for it. He finished a little farther away from 3,000. He had 2,326 hits, and the vast majority of those were singles because he only had 101 home runs his entire career.
Okay.
Drove in 950. He had, let's see, he was a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9-time All-Star. He was a 5-time Gold Glove winner and 2-time Silver Slugger winner. And his name, and I might be just trying, again, this might be a little partisan or homerism or whatever going on because I'm such a huge fan of the Cincinnati Reds and the Big Red Machine in the 1970s growing up as a kid. But Davey Concepcion.
Yeah.
The shortstop for the Big Red Machine was overshadowed by Joe Morgan to his left, by Pete Rose to his right, by Tony Perez a little further over, by George Foster out in left field, by Johnny Bench behind the dish. We know the Big Red Machine, one of the greatest collections of talent in the history of the sport.
Yep.
And Davey Concepcion was one of my favorite players. And I just gave you the numbers. 23. He was a guy that you could count on to bang the ball wherever it needed to go at a given time. He wasn't gonna bop it off the wall like Morgan or over it like Bench or Foster or whatever. But he was just one of those guys where you felt very
yeah.
good if it was a clutch situation and Concepcion steps in.
Right. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
just another name.
No, that's a great one. When you talk about this kind of subject, especially when you're thinking of trying to not get power hitters, a great time to go is also some of the good hitters. From the famed dead ball era. I got one. Here's one for you, for example. They named the team after him, for goodness sake. Napoleon Lajoie. He only had 82 career home runs because of the era he played in. But this is a guy who actually hit 400 one time. 5 batting titles.
Yep.
Let's see. 4 times where he led the league in hits, and all 4 of those times were over 200. He had 32-43 for his career. And they named a team after him, for goodness sake.
I got another one here that's more modern so people can understand. You're right about the Naps, by the way, the Cleveland Naps. But here's another one. We got a Twitter user following me on Twitter who said 2 names, Boggs, which we already had right out of
right.
the gate. We started this conversation with Ichiro, Boggs, Rod Carew, Tony Gwynn. Those
and
were
Pete Rose was to make
Rose
your top 5, really.
On.
Yep, that's 5.
And we've since continued on to that. But somebody just added this on air and tweeted at me and said, Mark Grace. Mark Grace, that's a great example. That is another guy, not a big long ball
right.
hitter, but a great guy with a bat in his hands. Maybe not to the level of Boggs, maybe not to the level of Ichiro and others, but he is a guy who fits that bill. Mike is in Woodville. Let's see who Mike wants to add to our list. Mike, go right ahead, sir. Hello, Mike.
Well,
can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. The one that one of them I was going to add just got mentioned, Mark Grace. A couple of them else that I thought of, you know, George Brett, another good pure hitter, Tris Speaker from your dead ball era.
Right.
Another guy that I thought of that just always seemed to put the bat on the ball was another speedster outfielder, Otis Nixon from back
yeah,
with the
I remember
Braves
Otis very
and,
well. Yeah, I remember Otis very well. I don't know that I would have put his name into this conversation simply because I don't know what his career numbers were, but the number of
I don't either. I'm driving.
Near the, you know, in the thing, but and that's okay. But George Brett is another great example. Again, a Hall of Famer, a great hitter of all kinds. You know, he's in a way, in a small sort of way, kind of more like Miguel Cabrera and Albert Pujols in that he also had really, really good power. But as a guy who is just always going to get you that base hit, great control of the bat, one of the greatest, commands of the plate and of the strike zone from a hitter's perspective that we've ever seen. That's a great one.
I thought Brett only hit 30 home runs maybe once though. I mean, I thought he had a lot of X-ray hits, but.
Well, here, his home run totals 23, 24, 21, 25, 30, 22, 24, 317 career. So, you know, again, not like he's up into the you know, 500 club era, but to me,
true.
when you hit 317, 1500 runs driven in, which is one of the top totals all time too, and a career batting average of, if I can pull this up real quick, just to kind of throw it out there. He had 3,154 hits, and his career batting average is 305. So, yes, I'm with you on George Brett. He fits that bill a lot more. And the other thing you have to look at, too, is strikeout totals. He struck out 908 times in 21 years of baseball. 908 right. strikeouts in 21 years is a pretty doggone good rate. Because the guys who, you know, who have the best bat control that we talk about, who put the ball in play, are the guys who don't strike out a ton.
Yeah.
And that's a great example of it.
And to throw it out for you guys, I do have Otis Nixon's numbers, for example. 270 career hitter, 1379 career hits in his 17 major league seasons. Never hit more than three homers in a year. I have 9-0. So he had nine seasons where he didn't hit a single one. So there's an example of definitely a guy
It's a guy who just all he did was hit singles. But to me, there just wasn't nearly enough of them for him to be counted in a list like this. We're talking about the greatest singles hitters, not just guys who only hit singles.
Right. No. Yeah, absolutely. No doubt. Now, this guy did have some power, but you guys just made me think of it due to the lack of strikeouts. Joe DiMaggio. Joe DiMaggio in 6,800 plus at-bats only struck out 369 times in his whole career.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Amazing. That is an amazing statistic right there. How many career at-bats did you say?
6,821 career at-bats and only 369 career strikeouts.
Well, just to compare that to Brett, because I brought up George Brett, he had 10,349 at-bats, so over 4,000 more ABs for his 900.
Of course, DiMaggio missed 3 years right smack in the middle of his career because of the war.
And as long as we're doing that, Tony Gwynn, who was kind of at the top of this list that we talked about, Tony Gwynn, in 9,288 at-bats, struck out just 434 times. Career batting average, as we know, 338, just 135 RBIs, maybe the gold standard for the stat that we're talking about right now.
Yeah, that is definitely up there.
All right, good stuff, Mike. Thanks for the call.
Like
we appreciate
I said,
it.
Take it easy.
Yeah, have a great great evening. Let me get a time out here. We'll get a Sports Center. We'll continue this conversation. And if we have time, maybe even get into the other big news story yesterday involving Alex Rodriguez. He is done as of Friday. And what does that mean? How is his career going to be remembered? One of the greatest talents in the history of the game. One of the greatest young prospects in the history of the game. Not too far removed from the prospect that Junior Griffey was when he came up as the number one pick. And, of course, they had to play together. And Alex Rodriguez had the entire world at his disposal. And yet his memory, his legacy, is going to be of something very, very different than the 696 career home runs and the all-time talent and the all-time gold glove. He was a tremendous gold glove shortstop who gave up the position for Derek Jeter when he went to the Yankees and moved over to third base. And yet he is one of the most despised guys ever. So as we talk about Ichiro Suzuki, oh, by the way, did we look up Ichiro's, Jim? His strikeout total, just since we were doing it?
Oh, no, yeah, I didn't check that number. Let me look that up real quick.
I'm going to see if I can do that. I'll tell you what, let's get the break. Let's get the break here. We'll get a Sports Center. We'll come back and continue this conversation on the other side. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And on 106.5 The Ticket.
You're a googly moogly.
Onward we roll. It is 4:47. The Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza. Take you until 5 o'clock. Drive Time with Mike Miller coming your way after that. I was just looking up. I got another tweet from Aaron, who brought up Mark Grace and Wade Boggs, and I told him I already mentioned Boggs, and he said he didn't hear that part. He's just driving home from work now, which is fine. So I went ahead and sent him a note saying all the names that we've kind of thrown up there now. If you just turned on the radio, too, if you just got off work, we're honoring Ichiro Suzuki, who had his 3,000th career hit last night. It was a triple. Off the wall in right center, I think I heard that clip.
Yeah.
Do you have that clip again there, Jim?
Yes, I do. Let me
hear that Ichiro Suzuki's 3,000th hit one more time, because that's why we're paying homage to all of these great hitters who were never great power hitters. They were just plain great batsmen.
The 2-0. Ichiro to right and deep. Back goes Parra to the wall, and it's off the wall! 3,000 is in right field, and Ichiro is racing for third, and he's done it! He's climbed the mountain, a triple, and he has arrived at 3,000.
Baseball history made today.
No question about it. Baseball history. Anyway, that got us going on the issue of who were the greatest batsmen. You know, because when you talk about great hitters, do you have to include power in that or not? And guys like Tony Gwynn, just one of the guys, best guys to ever hold a bat in his hands, because he could just put it anywhere and make solid contact, and that's how you end up with a career batting average of .338, for God's sake. Tony Gwynn, Wade Boggs. These are some of the gold standards of just, you know, batsmen, guys who are just great guy, you know, guys who are just great with the bat, not necessarily power hitters. So anyway, as I sent the note to Aaron, these are the names that have kind of crossed our lips as we discussed this thus far. Tony Gwynn, Wade Boggs, who is right up there among the very best. Those two might be the gold standards, but Gwynn, Boggs, Rod Carew. Rod Carew is a guy not a lot of people talk about. He's from the 1970s mostly. His heyday was in the 70s. He started in the 60s. He was a rookie in 1967, played through 1985. In 19 years, Rod Carew amassed, a total of 3,053 hits, career batting average of .328. Never hit more than 14 home runs in a year. Had a grand total of 112 in his career. His strikeout total is a little bit higher than some of the other guys we've had on this list, Rod Carew. It's 1,018. But his highest total was 91 as a rookie. Then he had 81 in his fifth year, 1971. And the rest of them all 62 or less. So just one of the great bat control guys of all time. So, excuse me. So we've had Gwynn, Boggs, Carew, Pete Rose himself, who is, the hit king and remains so, even though Ichiro Suzuki now has 4,278 career base hits between Japan and the majors, 3,000 here, 1,278 there. But of Rose's 4,256, the vast majority were singles, some 3,200. Never a great power hitter, obviously, but just a great, great bat control guy. I threw the name of Omar Vizquel up there with his 2,800-plus base hits. He was just a tremendous guy to have up. You know, it's weird, Jim. In those 90s Indians teams where they won the division like five times in 7 years.
Right.
And two World Series appearances and American League flags and all that stuff. And you got Jim Thome and Kenny Lofton and Albert Bell and Manny Ramirez and all these great Dave Winfield and Eddie Murray and all these great hitters who were part of that. You would think that clutch situation, you want one of those guys coming up. Anytime there was a clutch situation and Omar was coming up, it's like Omar, the banjo hitter, he was the guy I felt most comfortable with. If I didn't need a home run here and I just need a single to score the guy from second to take the lead or to tie the game, I was loving it if Omar Vizquel was at the dish. And people don't give him enough credit for that. He was so consistent with the bat. And
what's also amazing when you reference Vizquel and all that too is think of back when they got him in the winter of 93 going into 94. At the time he was, well, you got an outstanding glove, but he's got a real light bat. And at the time, in his very early days of his career with the Mariners, he didn't really do much with the bat. He improved steadily to get to the point where you're talking about over his time in the 11 years in Cleveland. Yep. And by the time he left, it's like, then the conversation became, and I still feel it should be a conversation going forward because he's going to be eligible for the Hall of Fame vote in a couple years here, is, was he really better than Ozzie Smith? And maybe I'm biased on this. I kind of think he was because they were both incredible with the glove. And I kind of think Vizquel was a little better with the bat than Ozzie Smith was.
I would agree with that. We've had this conversation before in another context. I don't remember exactly what it was. But just to throw it out there since you brought it up, Omar, and what will hurt Omar with the Hall of Fame voters will be the .272. .272 batting average. But if you look at the total hit number, .2877. And if you look at the clutch factor, and that matters. And then you look at the gold gloves, 11 of them. 11 gold gloves, 3 times an all-star. It's a complete player that deserves that consideration. For the Wizard of Oz, the Wizard had more gold gloves. He had 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. He had 13 of them. And his career batting average was only .262. How about that? He had 2,400 hits, so that's about 400 fewer than Vizquel had.
Mm-hmm.
Omar Vizquel had 80 home runs, I believe, in his career.
I'm looking at Ozzie Smith. Ozzie Smith
was 69.
You're looking at the triples number. He had 28 career homers.
28?
And his most famous homer was in a playoff game.
Yes, it was. So, yeah, and the wizard is there. I have absolutely no doubt that Omar Vizquel deserves that same consideration. I agree with you. But anyway, back to my points. We can get some other callers in. We had Omar's name there, George Brett,
yep.
Mark Grace, Paul Molitor, and I threw in, I don't know if anybody agrees or not, but I threw in the name of Davey Concepcion, another all-star shortstop with, I think, 9 gold gloves, 2,326, only 100 fewer than Ozzie Smith, by the way, in a career 267 average. Davey Concepcion was another one of those great bat control guys.
And I threw out some names from the dead ball era, Ty Cobb, Napoleon Lajoie, for example. It's hard to picture, of course, those guys
because that was even before radio existed
100 years ago. And the dead ball era was conducive to non-power hitters because there just weren't any in those days.
Right, exactly right. Jeremy is in Perrysburg. Let's get another thought on the radio. Jeremy, thanks for joining us. Go right ahead, sir.
Jeremy, how are you doing?
We're good, Jeremy, buddy. Go ahead.
Hey, I was just, first of all, I wanted to say I appreciate this conversation. It's nice to not think about who the individual greatest person is, but just to reminisce and think about all the good players.
Absolutely. Especially in a category like this, it's impossible to say who is the very best of them all. We just want to give all of them their credit, including Ichiro.
Exactly. And that was amazing. And it's been nice, one of the first players that I got to see go all the way through their career and accomplish that much.
That's a great point. We got to see, you know, in our adult years, him start with hit number one and go to hit number 3,000. And then I can't say that about too many other guys where I saw all of them based on, you know, when he came in. So that's a great point, too.
It is. But I'm going to go ahead and I've never been like a numbers guy of keeping up with who had these. And sometimes it surprises me when I've seen them. And when I looked it up, mm-hmm. Craig Biggio,
that's a really good, somebody else brought him up, or at least his name came up when I was just looking for ideas on the greatest, you know, bat control guys, and somebody brought up Biggio, but when I think of Biggio, and maybe I'm doing it incorrectly, I think of a guy who's more, he was kind of a blend of a power hitter and of a bat control guy, because he had some 300 career home runs, I think. Kinda
291.
Like
really? He had 291 career homers. I have his page up right now. 3,060 hits. He was a career 281 hitter, so he has a nice blend of all of those. And quite frankly, looking at his numbers, he didn't really start showing the power until about his sixth year in the league.
Yeah, that's interesting. Not to dismiss him from this list at all, Jeremy, but I think
the thing that
separates him apart from it, I think the greatest comparison to him that we already have on the list would be George Brett, because Brett had 317 home runs to Biggio's 291, so both of them are up there in about that same range. Biggio drove in 1175, Brett drove in 1596. The difference being Brett was a 305 career hitter, Biggio 281. That's a pretty significant jump there. That's about a, 24-point separation between that. So, again, bat control, able to put it in play, as well as pop it out of the yard if need be. I think those guys are pretty comparable. I would give the edge to Brett if I had to pick one of them to put on the list and couldn't do that.
I'd have to go there, too. And if I could say one thing last on the way out, I read an article not too long ago that said that somebody from Japan or when Ichiro came over is that he could have hit as many home runs as he wanted to, but that's not what he wanted to do.
Really?
Somebody
said in Japan that that's what Ichiro could do? Ichiro could pop it out of here anytime he wanted to?
And I might be just out of not the right kind of quote, but it was from a newspaper article on Yahoo, and they had said that if he wanted to hit for power, that he honestly could have anytime he wanted to. It's something to look up if you can.
I'm glad you brought it up because I was just going back over some of Ichiro's Japanese numbers. Cause that's where part of this started, of course, guys, was,
178 hits over there. Yeah.
Let's see. He had over 20 homers twice in Japan. Please remember, in the major leagues with Seattle, he only broke double digits twice in his whole career in the majors. But all but his first 2 years, which were part-time, he was double-digit homers in all those seasons, and two of them he cracked 20.
There you go.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you know what? I'm not surprised by that. There are some guys who I think could probably do the same thing. They could hit home runs if they wanted to, but they prefer, they know that with the bigger swing and with that extra long swing, it comes a lower batting average, and they feel like they have more to offer their team by getting on base over and over and over again than by jacking one and then missing three times, you know, and unfortunately that's what a lot of power hitters do. And then, you know, a guy like Ichiro, if he's got the ability to do both.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.